but maybe we could start with you introducing yourself, Luna, for people who might not know who you are and what you do. Tell us a little bit about your YouTube channel and maybe a little bit about your background, because I think it's going to come up, obviously.
Absolutely. Hi, everybody. I'm Luna. I'm a Vietnamese communist born and living in Vietnam. I have my channel named Luna Ơi. You can find me on YouTube, on Twitch, and also I'm on Means TV. My channel, I mostly talk about, well, fun stuff such as traveling vlogs. I show you my travels in Vietnam, and I also teach you how to make how to cook Vietnamese food, and I show you like the authentic Vietnamese recipes, vegan versions always included. And of course, I talk about politics. I explain to you what's going on in Vietnam, my life experience over here, and also explain about our system and our society. Very nice to talk to you and to be here today.
Yes, thank you for that. I'm going to definitely link to your channel. At the outset, before we get into Rice Fieldgate, the pressing news cycle of Twitter, of online stupid Twitter world, before we get into that profound issue, yeah. I was thinking maybe you could kind of spend some time talking about the Vietnamese anti-colonial struggle, because, I mean, at the outset, I think what's most remarkable for me as somebody who, like, doesn't know any of this history, just knows it from, like, you know, the lore around Vietnam and, like, Vietnamese resistance.
Yes.
There is this kind of lore. And, you know, but of course, the little bit that I know is that, oh, it wasn't just one empire, it was two that the Vietnamese fought off over the course of, what, 50 years?
Yeah.
They basically spent half of the 20th century trying to attain more. It was, you know, 1970, whatever. So maybe we can kind of get the understanding of how this modern country of Vietnam comes into existence. Maybe a little bit even about the language. I think there might be, like, I'm personally confused about, the simplest question I have is, like, when did we drop the term Indochina?
Yeah.
Because you read that in, like, Chomsky books and stuff from, like, the 60s, and, like, a lot of the conversation around, you hear the word Indochina.
Yeah.
But I feel like that's the holdover from, like, the French kind of orientalist thinking of, like, but yeah.
Yeah.
But anyways, that's a bunch of, I'm, you know, we're in Professor Luna Oi's office, and office hours are starting on everything you want to know about Vietnam.
Sure, I would love to talk about this. So talk about the history of Vietnam. Well, Vietnam, we have a very rich history that started like thousands of years ago. You can say that the whole like history of Vietnam is a history of resistance. At first, like for thousands of years, we were fighting against like in the feudal time, you know, like we fighting against like the kings or the kings in the north. At that time, we call it the king in the north, the kings, all kind of kings in the north. So, like we've been fighting for our independence since like thousands of years. I mean, they formed the older kind of kingdoms of China, like so long time about like that. So about the modern history of Vietnam, in the like 19th centuries, the French came to Vietnam and attacked us and literally colonized the whole country of Vietnam for more than 100 years. Then the struggle continued until the day when we won the Vietnam the Điện Biên Phủ victory in 1954. And immediately the USA jumped in and we had continued fighting against the US imperialism until like 1975. And
the place is Dien Bien Phu in French Indochina. The year is 1954. The lonely jungle outpost surrounded by communist guerrillas and accessible only by air is doomed, just as the once mighty French colonial empire in Southeast Asia is doomed. This is the end of 8 years of bloody fighting in Vietnam, a shadowy, sinister war that has cost France dearly. A war whose last great tragedy is the final fateful surrender of the garrison at Dien Bien Phu. At Geneva, half a world away, Vietnam is carved in two as the weary and discouraged French hand over the northern part to the communists. The Red Star is raised over Hanoi, capital city of the new communist state, as the tide of tyranny surges southward, and the people, young and old, make ready to greet the victorious Red Armies. The conquerors come with promises of peace and no new aggression against the South. But peace, under communism is not for these Vietnamese. Almost 1 million refugees turn their faces from red rule and flee with only the clothes on their backs. And in South Vietnam, they help make a miracle come true. Farmlands are redistributed so that peasants own their land and reap the benefits of their toil. And year after year, starting with 1954, the rice harvest grows greater and greater. A determined, hard-working people prosper under freedom, while their neighbors to the north watch with growing envy and apprehension. With technical assistance from America and the free world, South Vietnam sets out to develop its natural resources, to mine the coal that, for example, is the nation's single most important mineral. Thus, from an economy born in post-war chaos, comes a country with currency reserves at a record high. Near the southern coast of South Vietnam is the picturesque gateway to the ancient land, the port city of Saigon. More than 2 million persons live in the teeming metropolis, with tree-lined streets and broad boulevards that preserve the memory of the departed French. Here can be found, more than in any other place, the contrast between old and new in South Vietnam. Here schools are filled with children learning to read and write, in a land where illiteracy has been a legacy from generation to generation. Education, cornerstone of freedom, has found enthusiastic support in the new country, and enrollment in elementary schools has tripled in the last 6 years. A deeply religious people, the South Vietnamese have found strength in their Buddhist faith, strength to survive the early trials of independence, and to lift their hearts and eyes gratefully, hopefully. President of the Republic is Ngo Dinh Diem, staunchly anti-communist, who has won the respect of his people by leading South Vietnam since its founding. Today, Diem faces perhaps the greatest challenge of all. Once again, free men, this time Vietnamese, must arm and defend themselves and their country against communist infiltration and sabotage.
It just did not end at that. We continue to fight against the USA sanctions for the next 30 years, all the way, like, actually, the whole history of Vietnam, we only had, like, the real freedom and independence and self-determination in 2006. It's very, like, very, 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 like, modern time like that. Just 15, 16 years ago, we had our true peace time to rebuild our country. So as I said, like,
it's so crazy to think, yeah, like, that's like they had like a relay race of imperialism. They like finished one. They finished one leg of it.
Yeah.
Like one, the first runner gave up and they passed the baton over to the Americans,
yeah,
to continue the job. Yeah. I mean, it's like mind blowing.
Yeah.
Why was Vietnam so strategic? It was because of the Cold War thinking, obviously, in the U.S. case. But in the French case, these were the kind of outer provinces of their Chinese empire? Or what was the kind of regional calculus of the French?
Like, wow, what do I say? So as I said, the French first came to Vietnam in like the 19th century, something like that, around that time. And at that time, they still keep the king. They still kept the king, the royal family, but like they heavily control all over Vietnam. And they exploit the shit out of Vietnamese people horribly.
Around 1860, the French seized the area near Saigon. They took over central and northern Vietnam during the next two decades. And by 1885, Vietnam had once again lost its independence. French Indochina at the end of the 1880s. Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam, which the French divided into three regions. Cochin China, Annam, and Tonkin. To the Vietnamese, the division was a deliberate attempt to destroy their national unity. The first moving images of the new colonies were recorded in the early 1900s. France looked at the traditional Indochinese cultures and saw very little it considered civilization. The colonizers took upon themselves the French version of the white man's burden, la mission civilisatrice, the bringing of civilization and Catholicism to the natives. The Vietnamese resisted, The French called all resistors pirates, and they sent in the troops for the first pacification of Vietnam. They staged public executions. The severed heads were photographed and printed on postcards, which soldiers sent home to sweethearts in Paris with kisses from Hanoi. It took 20 years to get the Vietnamese resistance under control. Then the French could concentrate on the economics of colonialism, trying to transform Vietnam into a source of profit. They opened factories and expanded the mines in the north. In the south, they developed tea, rubber, and rice plantations. Indochina exported rice to 30 countries. An export stayed high, even if it meant the peasants starved.
The people here suffered a lot because of high taxes and hard forced labor. They worked from dawn till dusk, but they did not have enough to eat.
The cheap labor profited a few French companies, even though Indochina was a financial sinkhole. The French nation spent millions of francs each year to protect and support the colony, while French companies like Michelin Rubber made millions in profits from factories and plantations. French newsreels showed only clean, modern workplaces. But in fact, the Vietnamese worked under the most brutal and degrading conditions.
In the rubber plantations, the workers were treated so inhumanely that they died young and died in droves. There was a saying that the workers were fertilizer for the rubber trees because their corpses were buried under the trees.
Things that got even way worse in the World War I and World War II, you know? Actually, like after World War I, when the World War I was happening, France was kind of a little bit like left Vietnam and forgot Indochina a little bit. And by the way, the term Indochina came from, yes, the colonialists. They came here and they didn't even like bother to learn what we are. They just like, okay, this is between India and China. Just yeah, let's just call this Indochina. Yeah. Like, what the fuck?
Oh, it's like thinking like America is the halfway point between Canada and Mexico.
Yeah. So they call you like Mexicanada or something. It's really ding dong. Like, yeah. So it show you how racist they were to us. They didn't even bother to learn what we were. Just like, just call them something like Indochina. Like we're not Chinese and we're not like Indian. Like, what the fuck are you talking about? AKA Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. I hate the word Indochina, actually. Whenever I use it as a like sarcasm, all right? They a little bit forgot about Indochina because they were busy in the war. After World War I, they came back to Vietnam and exploited us even more because they want to compensate for what they lost in World War I. Things got even way worse in World War II because at that time, in the 1940s, the fascist Japan came to Vietnam, and they conquered Vietnam. It took over Vietnam heavily, horribly.
Oh my God, I totally forgot about the Japanese.
Yes.
They always get a pass, don't they?
Yes. Yeah, at that time. So like they were heavily exploited Vietnam in the period from like 1940 to 1945. At that time when they lost the World War II, so the French, they were supposed to come to Vietnam and to de-weaponize Japan and they wanted to take back Indochina, right? So they were supposed to do that. But the fact is this. The fascist Japan and the colonialist French, they work together. They both exploited Vietnamese farmer, even way worse than before. It shows like the hypocrisy of the French colonialists. Because they didn't care about Vietnamese, so they supposed to kick the Japan out of Vietnam, all right? But in fact, they worked together to exploit Vietnamese even more. So The result was that during just a period of a few years, from 1940 to 1945, over 2 million Vietnamese people died of starvation at that time. It was the worst, one of the worst history of starvation of Vietnamese people at that time. Because we both, the fascist Japanese, they stole the rice and everything, natural resources, all the way and brought them all the way back to Japan. At the same time, the colonialist French, they also exploited us and brought everything they can get back to France. It was really horrible time. And all four of my grandpa and grandmas lived through that time. And even until the day they die, when we cremated them, you know, like all the bones, like my grandma's bones would like mostly disappear, turn into like dust. Because she had to bear the terrible, terrible malnutrition during that 1940s years. So, yep. And after we had our communist revolution, we still managed to have our communist revolution, a successful one in 1945 with the leadership of Ho Chi Minh and the Communist Party of Vietnam. So we officially kicked out the Japanese army out of Vietnam. And we declare our independence. You know, it's very famous, you know, the Declaration of Independence of Vietnam written by Ho Chi Minh. Right after we claim our independence in 1945, the French immediately came back. And they wanted to take back Vietnam and Indochina one more time. And it led to the next 9 years of fighting against the French colonialism all the way until like 1954.
Meanwhile, the situation in French Indochina grows graver as bitter fighting sweeps through Hanoi, leaving misery and destruction in its wake. French troops move up country to engage the well-equipped forces of the Vietnam Republic, who made a desperate but unsuccessful bid to massacre the entire French population of the city.
Didn't you know, Luna, that was a period of European decolonization? Didn't you know that?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Didn't you know that? That's when they decolonized.
Yes. Yes. When they decolonized. Yeah, I learned all about this in school. In the history class, we were like, what the fuck? Like, they were decolonizing.
Yeah, No one told us.
So,
I mean, they were also doing this in Algeria too, right? Like, yeah, they were having this kind of like, yes, the last grasps of what they wanted to, like their great grand glory.
Yeah.
And they thought they could keep it, but Vietnamese taught them a lesson. I mean, there's also this crazy story of, to pull it back a little bit about Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah.
One thing I did learn about him is that he was a cook at the Paris Peace Conference.
Yes.
And he like petitioned these, you know, aristocrat ghouls who were running it, to speak on behalf of his people, and they rejected him.
Yes.
Demands of the Vietnamese people. Since the victory of the Allies, all the subjects are frantic with hope at prospect of an era of right and justice, which should begin for them by virtue of the formal and solemn engagements made before the whole world by the various powers of the Entente in the struggle of civilization against barbarism. While waiting for the principle of national self-determination to pass from ideal to reality, through the effective recognition of the sacred right of all peoples to decide their own destiny, the inhabitants of the ancient empire of Vietnam, at the present time French Indochina, present to the noble governments of the Entente in general, and in particular to the honorable French government, the following humble claims. 1. General amnesty for all the native people who have been condemned for political activity. 2. Reform of Indochinese justice by granting to the native population the same judicial guarantees as the Europeans have, and the total suppression of the special courts, which are the instruments of terrorization and oppression against the most responsible elements of the Vietnamese people. 3. Freedom of press and speech. 4. Freedom of association and assembly. 5. freedom to emigrate and to travel abroad. 6. Freedom of education and creation in every province of technical and professional schools for the native population. 7. Replacement of the regime of arbitrary decrees by a regime of law. 8. A permanent delegation of native people elected to attend the French Parliament in order to keep the latter informed of their needs. The Vietnamese people, in presenting these claims, count on the worldwide justice of all the powers and rely in particular on the goodwill of the noble French people who hold our destiny in their hands and who, as France is a republic, have taken us under their protection. In requesting the protection of the French people, the people of Vietnam, far from feeling humiliated, on the contrary, consider themselves honored, because they know that the French people stand for liberty and justice and will never renounce the sublime ideal of universal brotherhood. Consequently, in giving heed to the voice of the oppressed, the French people will be doing their duty to France and to humanity. In the name of the group of Vietnamese patriots, Ho Chi Minh.
So if you're ever wondering about electoralism, like that's all you need to know is that like
exactly.
A cook 100 years ago tried to speak on behalf of their people, and instead he was rejected, and it cost the imperialists 40 years of war.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of their big defeats.
The democracy under the bourgeois system is a joke.
Exactly. Well, they don't actually want democracy, obviously.
Yep.
Like they want vassal states and they can just dress it up as democracy. And so wait, it's okay. I interrupted you. So we are at the under the Ho Chi Minh and the communists, nationalists defeat the French in a bitter almost decade-long war.
Yeah.
And the famous sort of culmination of it is the Battle of Dien Bien Phu.
Yes. Yes.
Dien Bien Phu is the famous defeat of the French.
Yes.
And how long until after they leave, after Dien Bien Phu?
Vietnam had no rest after we won the Dien Bien Phu victory against the colonialist French. So this is how it actually worked, all right? So maybe like take a break from the version of history, the whitewashed version of Vietnam history that you study in schools or something. This is what actually happened according to our side, all right? In the 1950s, like early 1950s, you know that the US sided with the French, right? And they even helped supply a lot of food and weapons for the French in Vietnam. It was also like a story got revealed by a French general, something like that. Like before the Dien Bien Phu, before 1954, when the French they were losing horribly in the Battle of Vietnam, the USA offered nuclear bombs to the French general. And the French general declined because at that time, the French soldiers were located right next to the communist army. So like if they nuke the communist army, they're gonna kill their own soldiers. So that was the reason why they refused. Both of them didn't give a shit about Vietnamese people. The only reason why the French refused is just because, oh, we're gonna kill our soldier too. So just not take it. Yeah, this is the story itself was revealed by the French general who received that offer. This never got mentioned anywhere in the history of the USA.
This is around the time of the Korea War, right? And MacArthur wanted to nuke China during that war, I think.
Mm.
And Truman had to fire him or something. I don't know. Maybe it was, I don't know. But I wonder when this was, so this was exposed recently by a general that could have been nuked.
Yeah.
That they could have actually started a nuclear war in Vietnam.
It's so ugly.
They were so mad about losing.
Yeah. It's very ugly. So back a little bit about the USA in Vietnam in the 1950s. So the USA, on one hand, they backed the French heavily. On the other hand, they want to have a safe kind of plan B where they already plan to immediately jump in Vietnam if the French failed. And so, you know Ngo Đình Diệm, right? Ngo Đình Diệm was the president of the puppet regime in the south of Vietnam. Ngo Đình Diệm in the 1950s went to the USA to seek for help. Remember, 1950, we were still fighting the colonialist France in Vietnam. At the same time, Ngô Đình Diệm, he used to work for the king. He was like the prime minister of the king of Vietnam. When the king was dismantled, he's kind of trying to took back the power. And he came to the USA to seek for help. He spent 2 years in the USA to try to talk to like the churches and also talk to politicians in the USA to try to seek for help. And he got, finally, he was chosen because like he was like the best candidate for USA at that time or something like that. So he was chosen. And when he went back to Vietnam in 1952 or something, he already got backed by the USA. And when we won the Điện Biên Phủ victory in 1954, that victory was a very, very important history. Very important for Vietnamese history because it forced the, what do you call it, the whole like imperialist system, colonial system, to sit and talk with Vietnam in the Geneva Agreement. So in our Western history, the whole point of winning against the French in Điện Biên Phủ was to bring all of us to talk about our independence on a table in Geneva Agreement, you know, and finally we have a voice internationally. We have the voice to talk with a powerful nation on earth because of that victory.
Yeah, I mean, this is the one of the pioneering moments of, like, the Vietnamese are, like, some of the, like, most powerful examples of the meaning of the anti-colonial resistance and, like, anti-colonial nationalist resistance.
Yeah, yeah.
There's this thing in my part of the world where people say that, oh, I'm not down with nationalism. Nationalism is bad.
It's oh, like, my gosh, well, yes, yes.
You're a white person. It's usually a white person.
Very poor,
like,
understanding.
That's correct. You should be wary of white people who are nationalists.
Exactly.
But there are other people in the world whose idea of their nationality isn't necessarily linked to this corrosive, you know, evil heavy system of racialization now.
Yeah.
Are there other racist nationalisms? Of course.
Yeah.
Is nationalism inherently racist? No. So, like, the idea, and of course, like, and all these people who usually say this are, like, white Marxists. And it's like, don't you realize that white Marxists in Europe were the first nationalists?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were, like, the first people to, like, think, like, that was, like, that was nationalism as this tool developed, like, for this class consciousness. But, of course, where they live, they had this legacy of racism and imperialism for centuries.
Yeah.
That they had been trading people across the transatlantic, like, across the Atlantic for a long, long time, centuries at that point. Their civilizations were built on extortion, extorted labor. So, like, yeah, okay, it makes sense that, like, Europeans are like, yeah, nationalism is bad, or like a certain crew of them, but it's like not for other people. Other people use nationalism to defend their country. They seek out, like, the nationality is like, you know, I mean, I don't know, it's so silly to think of just people judging others for, like, being excited about the meaning of their country, and like they're like, oh, it's fake, it's fictional. It's like, yeah, we know it's like an imagined community, but you can still live with it. But it's also like the fakeness of a white settler colonial country is obvious, but, you know, Vietnamese people have existed for a really long time. They've had their own language, like, they developed a rich culture. Like, this is not for you to simply walk in and say that, oh no, you shouldn't be proud of where you come from and, like, your language and your, it's so stupid to just dismiss it. And, like, this nationalism is key to the Vietnamese revolution. Of course it is, because who the fuck wants to be occupied by four different empires at once?
Yeah, exactly. The thing that I made a whole video where I explain about all the forms of nationalism, all right? So the thing is that, like, I feel very disappointed when, like, white people from the imperial core, because their whole freaking life, they just encounter the right-wing nationalism, aka the fascist nationalism. So, like, they think that the whole world is like that. I'm sorry, but the whole world is not just white people, all right? Actually, the vast majority of the world population are non-white people. It's not like, in Vietnamese, we have an expression. It's ách ngồi đáy giếng. It means, like, you know, like when a frog living in a well, and the whole world is just a little teeny tiny well. And when they look at the sky, they just see the sky as big as a plate. And they claim that I am the king of this world. I know everything and nobody is smarter than me. To me, a bunch of white people who whine about the nationalism of non-white people, they are like those frogs living in their little teeny tiny well. And when we try to show the world outside that well, they panic and they refuse to even learn about it. That is very disappointing. It's racism, white supremacism, and chauvinism in a nutshell.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Yeah, no, it is. It's funny. It's like the platonic thing of, you know, are people living in the cave? And it's like the provincialism of a lot of white national, white settler colonial societies, like because you're insulated by English, because the whole world speaks your language, which is a big deal, like you're forced to like, people come and talk to you. People come and like see, and then because of the cultural hegemony that your culture industry kind of can flex on the world, that you can go to different parts of the world and, you know, eat foods that are from your country. And like that's like, you know, Americans have that cultural flex. Like, you know, when they build like Burger Kings and like Popeyes in like Kuwait and Bahrain and stuff, like that's like a, that's not a new thing. Of course, like it's settler, like imperial empires have done that. They've recreated their own home for their soldiers in different ways. But like, just like, it just exposes how little Americans have of their own identity, where it's just like, oh, just more of your stupid corporations that are slowly killing you with terrible food that's like slowly killing. Like, of course, yeah, the, how much more American could it get? That like, so like, I mean, yeah, we're going to get to the rice field gate because this is directly related to it because of a lack of understanding of some basics around sovereignty, land and stuff. By the way, while you were talking, I Googled it. It's Operation Vulture. That was the U.S. operation that would rescue French forces at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu via B-29 raids. And that's where the A-bomb, that's where the is offered. But yeah, should we talk about the American war now? The American phase?
Phase
of the Imperial War? Yes. Is it seen as one war by Vietnamese people?
No, it's like as two different war. And they have about like 4 years overlap on each other. So back a little bit when like Ngo Đình Diệm came back to the US, came back to Vietnam from the USA. That got the help from the USA already like that. So in 1954, after we won the Vietnam War victory and we went to the Geneva Agreement, at that time, the USA, they had a deal with the whole, conferences that, like, for now, during, from, like, 1954 to 1956, the period of 2 years, the USA will take over the south of Vietnam and they will temporarily chose to 17th parallel to be the temporary border between the north and the south of Vietnam. And in the south, they put Ngo Đình Diệm as the president of the puppet regime. And they even faked an election for him. There was no election. It was like totally a rigged one. And then Ngo Đình Diệm claimed that like 99% of South Vietnamese voted for him, but like there's no evidence for it at all right?
In the midst of diplomatic and military crises and personality clashes, South Vietnam holds an election. According to President Ngo Đình Diệm's government, almost 85% of Saigon's eligible voters and as many as 90% of those in the provinces turn out to cast their ballots for 123 members of the National Assembly. Other observers, however, say that since President Diem rules by decree under a national state of siege declared in 1961, there is neither much interest nor significance in the elections. President Diem and his brother and chief advisor, Ngo Dinh Nu, arrive at the polls. Both Mr. Nu and his powerful wife, who is now making headlines in Europe, were elected to the assembly almost unanimously. Both were unopposed.
So the USA immediately jump in. They settle a puppet regime in the south of Vietnam. The original agreement was this. In 1956, the whole country of Vietnam will have a general national election where Vietnamese both north and south can vote to choose for the reunification of Vietnam and who's going to be the president, all right? That's supposed to be the deal of the Geneva Agreement. But in fact, that election never happened. What actually happened is that, like, in 1956, the USA, even they got even report about this officially in the White House. Like, they had a research, and they said, like, if the election is held right now in 1956, at least 80% of Vietnamese people would vote for Ho Chi Minh. So they did their best to, like, stop that, and the election never happened. And that led to the Vietnam War, because, like, Vietnamese people were so sick of having a puppet regime in the South who constantly spread, like, anti-communist propaganda, who kill and torture our own people. All right? And the worst thing is that, like, if you read, like, I don't know, I read some about a few weeks ago, Nguyễn Cao Kỳ, he was the high-ranking member of the puppet regime of Vietnam. And when he was interviewed by some American, like, journalists or something, they asked him about the crime committed under the South regime. And they asked about, like, why so many Southerners in Vietnam supported the North. And he says that, like, well, we cannot persuade the Southerners, the Vietnamese Southerners, to support our regime, because most of the crimes that we committed were on the South. And if you go and Google and check out the bomb map by the USA in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, you can see that even though the USA claimed that they want to protect the South Vietnam, the Southerners of Vietnam, but most of the bombs were dropped in the South. And most of the Agent Orange was sprayed in the South, because millions of Vietnamese Southerners supported communism, because the puppet regime was so horrible. It was a fascist regime.
Chaos piles on chaos in the government of South Vietnam. Lieutenant General Khan, recent army strongman, survives an abortive coup, then is summarily exiled as ambassador at large, and receives what is almost a hero send-off in a last public appearance. The 19-hour rebellion in Saigon is led by Marine and Army units who announce the overthrow of General Khan in favor of a former colleague of Khan who is now South Vietnam ambassador to the United States. But a loyalist battalion moves into the city, and the rebels are persuaded to call the whole thing off without a shot being fired. The series of coups and counter-coups in South Vietnam since the overthrow of the Ngo Dinh Diem regime in 1963 becomes almost dizzying. Observers say it could be compared to a comic opera plot if the implications were not so serious for the entire world. A press conference is held by the junta that stopped this coup. Air Force General Cao Ki is one of the military leaders who seemingly bailed General Khan out of trouble, only to strip him of his command and order him out of the country on the face-saving diplomatic mission. No top leader has yet emerged from this present power elite. Dissension is already reported within it. With the civilians made bewildered or apathetic and the cream of the armed forces preoccupied by the incessant coups, the United States begins to use jet bombers directly against the Viet Cong guerrillas, and at the same time to resist international pressure for immediate negotiations with communist nations. In Saigon, life has returned to normal. People walk freely again. But after so many months of bombings, of riots, of armored tanks, who can say what is normal in Saigon?
So one thing that I've noticed is that, like, oh, this exactly sounds like a lot of regime change wars that are running today. They have obviously this proxy force that the imperialists can, you know, equip and fund and support, yeah, and hold up as some kind of, like, you know, a willing native force that's, you know, moderate, yeah, rebels or whatever. And, like, the same tools. I mean, that's the story of the partition of Korea. They were unpopular there. The country that's known now today is South Korea or whatever.
Yeah.
It's not South Korea, Republic of Korea. But, like, I don't know. Yeah, this is something very familiar to me in terms of the manufacture of a civil war. Which, so, like, yes, anytime you hear about, like, civil wars and stuff. So another thing I Googled as we were talking is that So in Vietnamese, these are the two different wars are known as the anti-French resistance war.
Yes.
And then the anti-American resistance war,
yes.
I guess.
Yes. Yeah, so in Vietnamese, it was called like the French resistance, we call it like Kháng Chiến Chống Thực Dân Pháp. It means literally the resistance against the colonialist France.
Yeah, there you go.
And then
call it what it is. Call it what it is.
And then about the Vietnam War, we called it like Kháng Chiến Chống Mỹ Xâm Lược. Cuộc Kháng Chiến Chống Mỹ Xâm Lược. We called it like, or it literally means like the resistance against the invasion of the USA.
Yeah. That's what it was.
Mm.
That's what it was.
So, yeah. Like, and the funny thing is, was like, well, Ngô Đình Diệm was installed by the USA, but he was also killed by the CIA in 1963, 1964. That was the democracy. Awesome, right? You install a puppet regime, and then you make sure that a democratic election never happened in Vietnam. And when even your installed puppet didn't follow you anymore, you just assassinated him.
You know, it's funny. The more I'm learning now, the more I realize that like Vietnamese have this connection to Iranians, and that we're both been uniquely victimized by the U.S. Empire.
Yes,
us in a totally different way than you guys.
Yes,
like it was never a direct war with us. It's always these proxy wars, and you know whatever. Like it's never. Yeah. It's a totally different history, but it's like what we share is this victimization.
Yes, exactly.
And
we all unite kind of, under the U.S. imperialism.
Yeah, well, it's like a shared experience. It's like, what happened? Like you stand around each other and you're like, show me your battle scars.
Yeah.
And so one thing, another overlap I'm noticing is that, and I guess you don't hear it as much, but I mean, it's crazy to think this too, is that today one of the most well-known fascist reporters, internet reporters, fake, grifters, obviously, is a Vietnamese guy, like a Vietnamese-American guy.
Andy Ngo,
like,
right?
Yeah, like Children of Gusano. Like he was probably Children of Gusano. How else would he be?
Fuck Andy Ngo. Fuck Andy Ngo. I'm so fucking tired of him. Jesus.
He doesn't need to be spoken of anymore. But like, you know, I'm sure that there were a lot of Gusanos that got good careers.
Yes.
In during the war, after the war, I'm sure.
Yes.
It's something that, you know, and you could probably recognize them a mile away. Do they still have this kind of obsession with Vietnam, or are they kind of over it with you guys?
No, they still. We all just wish them to be like, forget about us so like freaking much, but they're not. Actually, in my channel, Luna Oi on YouTube, I just uploaded about like a month or two ago, uploaded a video where I talk about where I debunk all the lies from a Republican Vietnamese diaspora in California, all the lies that she had. And she's like the typical Viet diaspora in California that extremely anti-communist, a delusional Republican. And it is painful. Actually, it is very painful to have to to live in the same world with those people, to share the same blood with those people. And they just straight up like fascist sympathizers and terrible liars like that. It's...
Yeah, and this is another thing that's like deeply familiar, is that one of the tools that US uses is this kind of identity violence, or at least a kind of sociological violence, where it targets the most reactionary elements of your society and it platforms them and it turns them into paragons. And in the case of Venezuelans, they gave him a presidency. They gave a guy fucking Juan Guaido. He's a fake president. They just elevated him. And so like the most reactionary elements get an express ticket, often, not always, to a media career or another, just some kind of comprador position. I mean, we should probably get into the American phase of this war, because it's so interesting that you and I think we're the same age, or a little bit. I'm 38.
I'm 30.
But we grew up in relatively around the same time. And so Vietnam War became refracted, at least to me, growing up in the kind of with American culture, kind of refracted through, well, we lost, but we learned our lessons, because look at this Iraq War. And so the Iraq Wars and this kind of various quote unquote successful regime change ops that they ran in the 90s, like the former Yugoslavia, for instance. Like those things, I feel like the Vietnam thing always was this weird spectral thing haunting U.S. foreign policy, or at least that's what the normies always say.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, that's what the normies always say. And I don't know if I really believe. I mean, I don't know. Who cares about? That's a pretty bigger question. But I guess in some ways, that's kind of where I'm thinking in terms of how it was refracted to us as this kind of this trauma for the boomers.
Yeah.
And
they cope so hard. They cope so hard that they still cannot admit that the USA just lost the Vietnam War.
Yeah. Yeah. And like the jokes are, and it's now, it usually comes to us refracted totally through the lens of boomer nostalgia. So like
in Oliver Stone's movie, the constant strain of living under the threat of a brutal death pushes the entire platoon over the edge, resulting in one of the film's most controversial scenes.
If there's any Vietnam veteran, combat veteran, that tells you something like that never happened, he's lying.
Stone's graphic depiction of the conflict gained critical acclaim, but for some, the scenes of abuse and murder of innocent villagers were a step too far.
Why the f*** didn't you listen to me?
Those kind of things did happen. Did they happen a lot? Did they happen every day? Did they happen with every unit that was in Vietnam? No, they didn't.
Although Stone's platoon wasn't involved in this incident, much of the movie was based on his own actions.
I blew my mind a few times. I mean, I would get very upset with the Vietnamese because they were mute, they didn't talk, they didn't speak our language, and they were sometimes completely fake. You know, they were scared of us, you know, I can't blame them.
Just like in the movie, Oliver Stone's unit uncovered a hidden bunker where villagers were taking refuge.
We're just like a bit scared ourselves, and this guy was refused to do something I had asked.
Get out of the hole!
Just confusion, and I ended up, as Charlie Sheen did in the movie, shooting at his feet.
Get out of the hole!
That is the moment you have to watch for, is when you raise the weapon. It's easy to go from here to here and shoot the guy.
Stone didn't cross the line. But like Chris Taylor, the lead character in Platoon, it signaled the start of his transformation from idealistic new recruit to battle-hardened survivor.
The movie was, in a sense, about my struggle to keep my own humanity going, and or call it a soul. The odyssey of Charlie Sheen in the movie becomes this struggle for his soul between the ignorance and racism and hardcore military attitude and this more tender side, which he preserves.
Did you happen to watch? I watched 30 seconds of it and I was disgusted. The horrible Ken Burns.
Yeah.
Like where he started the first sentence.
I watched like, I don't know, like three parts or something.
Yeah, wow, three parts. That's courageous. Like literally the first sentence is some abomination of like, the war in Vietnam was fought with good people, something like that. Some crazy, like just self-delusional, dishonest kind of historical whitewash.
Yeah.
It's a hard rain, they're gonna fall.
America's involvement in Vietnam began in secrecy. It ended 30 years later in failure, witnessed by the entire world.
And what did you see, my darling?
It was begun in good faith by decent people out of fateful misunderstandings, American overconfidence, and Cold War miscalculation. And it was prolonged because it seemed easier to muddle through than admit that it had been caused by tragic decisions made by five American presidents belonging to both political parties. Before the war was over, more than 58,000 Americans would be dead. At least 250,000 South Vietnamese troops died in the conflict as well. So did over a million North Vietnamese soldiers and Viet Cong guerrillas.
Chop swords in the hands of young children, and it's hard.
2 million civilians, North and South, are thought to have perished, as well as tens of thousands more in the neighboring states of Laos and Cambodia. For many Vietnamese, it was a brutal civil war. For others, the bloody climactic chapter in a century-old struggle for independence.
And it's like, wow, we came, like, it went from, like, America's defeat and, like, you know, born on the 4th of July, kind of Oliver Stone nationalism of, like, oh, stand up to the deep state, to, like, you know, Forrest Gump.
Like, I mean, you like, know what? Like, you know what? I was gonna tell you this. It's actually, like, the biggest lie in the three parts that I watched was this. It's in, like, in the third part or something. So, when Ken
Burns... This is the Ken Burns.
Yeah, yes, okay. The Ken Burns. So, when Ken Burns was reporting about the atrocities on both sides, of course, is that the game that they love to play, the atrocities on both fucking sides? But whatever.
Fuck off.
Oh, my gosh. So, they say, like, he reported something. Like, he was historian. Huh? All right? And this is the way he reported about it. He said... the atrocity committed by the North Vietnamese communists is like, some unknown Vietnamese officer in the North, communist officer, said that they rather kill the innocent people than let the criminal one leave or something like that. And he just told it, like, he didn't cite any source about who said it or where did he find those, like, people, and where did he get that claim? When, in fact, the slogan, rather kill the innocent than let a criminal leave, was a famous, very super famous slogan used by Ngo Đình Diệm in the president of the fascist puppet regime in the south of Vietnam. And that was the slogan he used when he ran campaigns to hunt for communists in the south of Vietnam. Ngo Đình Diệm literally used the guillotine, the real guillotine left by the French in the colonialists. When the French left Vietnam, they left 4 guillotines. And Ngo Đình Diệm used one of the very huge guillotine, dragged the guillotine all over the south of Vietnam, and literally executed anyone that he and his regime suspected to be communist. There was no trial at all. And he killed so many people that we cannot even have the exact accurate number of people who got executed by that regime. The calculation was about from 2,000 up to 26,000. Is that how disgusting Ken Burns was in that documentary?
Yeah, because ultimately Americans don't give a flying fuck about the people or the countries that they bomb. It's like a pure act of narcissism. Like, there are so many tiny or, like, not well-known documentaries about the Iraq invasion, like the second one, because cameras were cheap and they realized, I think, and I can barely watch them. For a while I was like not collecting them, but kind of like thinking about a project of kind of editing some. And kind of I had a folder of them, my hard drive. And most of them are American made. All of them, actually, what am I saying? Not American, but definitely not made by Iraqis. And there is this weird, you know, you see it, the few that I watched, I could get through. It's all about them. It's all about their feelings. And this is all the way up to Hollywood of like, oh, you know, like Oliver Stone, like, oh, poor Tom Cruise's character from Born on the 4th of July. Like, he really had a hard time being a fucking mercenary for the U.S. Empire.
Yeah.
And, like, I guess part of it, too, is that from the American side, God, we're talking so much about fucking Americans, but unfortunately, I can't help it.
Here's the thing.
The conscription part of it. The conscription part is what was so unthinkable because, you know, you'd get your letter or whatever, and, like, you know, I mean, I'm not doubting that was, like, a scary fucking thing. If that was me getting it, I'd be terrified, too.
Because
who the fuck wants to go, if you're not, like, a sociopath, who wants to go and join a fucking Empire military? Yeah. So, like, there is that thing of it, and that's kind of Oliver Stone. I don't know if he was actually recruited or he volunteered, but he was like a grunt and stuff. Like, that was kind of his is kind of dynamic, but like, I don't know. It's just so gross that we have to like, that what I've learned about this amazing country called Vietnam, which is like, I just learning today, like 15th populous country on the planet, 90 million people, like not a small out of the way country, but like a huge chunk of humanity lives in this part of the world.
Yeah.
And like had to suffer through two like cataclysmic wars. And like, maybe it, maybe just there, I know like you hear the stats a lot, but like, Can you, you're Vietnamese, you know, this is a history that affects you every day, I imagine. Like, the scale of the violence perpetuated against your country, like, can you like, fathom it? Or is it just, like, abstraction?
Even to this day, even nearly every single family in Vietnam will have of a member who died in the Vietnam War or injured by the Vietnam War. It was how horrible it is and how massive the scale of the atrocities of Vietnamese people have to bear. And even to this day, lots of farmland in Vietnam is uncultivatable because of toxin that got sprayed in Vietnam. Lots of farmers in that local area cannot have enough farmland because of the toxin. And because it was because of the atrocity committed by the USA. The thing is that, like, Vietnamese people, we will never forget our history. And if, to this day, there are still about 4 million people who are the victim of Agent Orange. And the fourth and the fifth generation were born already after the Vietnam War, but they still had birth defect from Agent Orange. So it is still a very huge problem, issue in Vietnam that Vietnam still has to deal with to this day. But the thing is that, like, we won the war. We had our own self-determination and freedom and liberation. So we tend to forgive. We are forgiving people. We don't want to seek for revenge. No, nothing like that. We just want the USA, the West, the capitalist West, to leave us the fuck alone so we can build our socialist path, so we can rebuild and recover our country from the horrible atrocities from the wartime. Even to this day, 2021, Vietnam is still recovering from the war because we were bombed to the Stone Age. We were sprayed with like 80 million liters of all kind of toxins, including 366 kilograms of Agent Orange dioxin, the most poisonous substance that human have ever known of. So the atrocity, the scale of atrocity is massive. And it's really hard for even Vietnamese to really, really fathom the whole full scale of it. And it's painful. Too. It's very painful. So whenever I think about the history of Vietnamese people, yes, we are very proud of our history, proud of the fighting spirit that we have. We relentlessly fighting for our own freedom. But we know the price for it. 3 million Vietnamese people were killed in the Vietnam War. We want to move on. The past is the past, and we want to move on. But we will never forget. And we will make sure that the USA or any country on earth could never do that to us again. Because it's already too painful and that's enough. That's it. And we will, nobody should ever mess up with Vietnam again, because we're gonna fight to death to maintain our own liberation and freedom.
I knew a guy in Venice, California, and he was like a little bit older than me, and he had developmental challenges and from birth, obviously, from because his dad had walked through Orange, Agent Orange. Like up to his waist, he would say. We're just walking through it, and that's one, like, I don't know, one sort of like thread in this entire massive fucking tapestry of pain and suffering, of just like, you can still see this insane, like, genocidal war waged by, you know, nice, respectable, like, Robert McNamara. Like, got a whole documentary made about him recently, you know. Like, yeah. He got, you know, he was like a wonk. It was like the scientific war. It was testing out all these new things. A lot of the stuff that Iraq II would actually become, especially in terms of biometrics, like the second Iraq war invasion.
Yeah.
They was a huge social transform. It was an opportunity to collect all kinds of biological information about the people they were occupying. I mean, it's insane. Like the scale of American brutality, violence, evil, whatever you want to call it, rapaciousness of their military is unrelenting. And this is something that, you know, some countries of the world, and one of them is Vietnam, probably most intimately, has learned that, like, you can fight them off. It'll just, a lot of your people will go with it. I mean, it's just crazy. But, like, the thing is that, like, think about what they were trying to do, how the audacity of it.
Yeah.
Here is this country that is clearly communist that they can't just dislodge. So they had to try to separate it. They tried to, like, you know, they tried to partition it. They tried to make it a work.
Yeah.
And in the end, they had to, like, when none of those things work, when you can't rule by proxy through, like, pliant, you know, like, brutal dictators, whatever, actual dictators, even though it's a term I hate, like, those are, like, then they invade you. That's, like, the full case. That's, like, so you got, like, the entire gamut of the U.S. foreign policy, like, you know, approach, like, from regime change all the way to, you know, genocidal war.
Yeah.
And then sanctions too, right? We should talk about sanctions.
Yes, let's talk about it.
You weren't even, they weren't even done with you.
I was born under that sanction, so I know exactly.
So was I. Like, yeah, so was I. God, I was born, well, I was born during our war was fought with Iraq, obviously. They used a proxy. But yeah, it's same story.
Yeah.
Sanctions. What was life like in those early days? This was the 80s and early 90s?
Yeah, so the sanction, the whole history of sanction was this. When, you know, during the Vietnam War, when 1954 with the North and South of Vietnam, the sanction was imposed in the North of Vietnam since the 1950s, like that, right after the Geneva Agreement, all the way to the end of the Vietnam War in 1975, because we won the Vietnam War, we kicked out the USA and ended the existence of the puppet regime. The USA, right from the 1975, they imposed a severe comprehensive sanction on Vietnam all the way until 2006, all right? So a lot of people misunderstood it and say, like, when, because, like, Vietnam and the USA started talking with each other about the sanctions in 1994. So lots of people, of course, Americans, they thought that, like, well, the sanction ended in 1994. But no, it's not. We just started talking about it in 1994, all right? 20 fucking years after we already, the whole country got imposed by it. And it took, like, the whole procedure took, like, 12 years. Until 2006, when Vietnam and the USA finally, totally normalized our relationship. That was the mark when the last embargo was lifted out of Vietnam. And 1 year after that, in 2007, Vietnam joined the World Trade Organization. And it was a very good news in Vietnam. I remember at the time I was like 15, 16. And it was a huge, huge news in Vietnam that we talk about it for weeks, about how the sanction finally ended and we joined the World Trade WTO and finally we can trade with other countries. We are not going to be this miserable anymore. I was born in 1991. And at that time, well, let me see. I live in my small house that you still see it if you go to my channel and check out my poor Vietnamese kitchen, and I made a salad in my family's kitchen. I grew up without having stable electricity. It was like that. It was like one day with the electricity and one day without electricity, I would live like that. And of course, I didn't have any clean water. We had our own family's teeny tiny well and the water was extremely contaminated. It was totally yellow water. And my dad had to build our own like filter system from like sand and gravels and coal, you know, to clean the water, to filter the water for our family. We also like, my favorite snack was grilled grasshopper because I didn't have anything else to eat at that time. No candy, no sugar, no milk, nothing. I talk all about my detailed childhood in the video in my on my channel. The name was My Vietnamese Childhood Under the U.S. Sanction. And if you want to know more about it, you can go watch it. But generally speaking, it was a time when... it's like, I don't know how to describe it to you. It was extreme poverty. We didn't have even any, like, we just only had, like, basic medicine such as, what do you call it? The antibiotics and vitamins. That's it. Even though, theoretically, the sanctions didn't put the heavy, like, stops on any medicine and supplies and food like that. But in reality, no country dared to trade with Vietnam at that time because they were afraid of the secondary sanction might be imposed on them if they trade with Vietnam. So mostly all the stuff that we had was like made in Vietnam by Vietnamese people with our very limited resources due to the devastation and the destruction from the Vietnam War. And also like we illegally traded with like Laos a lot at that time with about basic foods and clothes. The kind of the country that had Vietnam the most at that time were the USSR. Oh no, this is all the like in the 70s and in the 80s. In the 90s, they already like got like, well, collapsed, so we cannot seek for help anymore. Cuba, actually, Cuba was the country that helped us the most. Cuba was the only one country that sent vaccines to Vietnam and saved millions of Vietnamese children. In my vein right now, Cuban vaccines is running inside my veins. And I was saved by the Cuban vaccines. I would have died. You know, I could have died without the vaccine from the Cuba. So that was why, like, the relationship between Vietnam and Cuba was very, has been always so very powerful and strong. And you know what? The relationship between Vietnam and Iran also always very good. You know about the new incident with, like, the Iranian... the Iran like government is keeping one like oil vessel.
Vietnam, the tanker.
Yeah. It's disgusting. It's disgusting because like the way it got reported in the Western media outlet was like exactly. But like you know what? It's actually news running in the Vietnamese like communist Facebook space. Actually the Iran government is protecting the tanker of Vietnam.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Mm. I didn't know that.
Yes, that's the truth. That's the truth.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. Apparently Vietnam is one of the few countries to express support for the Iranian revolution.
Yes.
So that's great. So this is a shared mutual connection.
so this is a new source from Vietnamese side. So actually like Vietnam, we were bringing oil back and forth from Vietnam and Iran. All right.
Wow. And so that's one of the tankers was Vietnamese or?
Yeah, it's something, or, something like that. And that tanker was about to be captured by the American vessels. And the Iranian government actually, they, on the theory, like on the outside, they arrest us first. But the real purpose behind it is to protect us from the arrest from the USA like vessel. Yeah, that's like a,
right, so,
a protection.
Yeah, I'm looking online now. Based on previous movements and prior loading, we strongly suspect that the vessel Iran seized is the Vietnam flag tanker Southeast.
Yeah.
Southeast is currently located. Oh, wow. Oh, we had good time. This is good timing for the two of us to do this connection. It's so funny how the US relations to like its enemies are like the pattern is always the same. Like it's such a sore loser.
Yeah.
Like if they're forced out, of course they have to seek out like the most vengeful sanctions, because God forbid your enemy gets strong.
Yeah.
God forbid that they build up any resources and that they could hurt you and like maybe come back and get their revenge on you for all what they did.
Mm. Yeah. So yeah, big solidarity between Vietnam and Iran. We always have a very good relationship. Very, very good.
Thank you very much, Luna. Luna, tell us where to find your work. Tell us what you're working on. Anything exciting to point us to?
Yeah. Okay, sure. Please go check my channel out, Luna Oi, on YouTube, Twitch, and Minz TV. For now, I am working on my script where I explain in detail about our agriculture system in Vietnam, about how I got my piece of rice field and how it means to me, and also like show you the actual law of Vietnam about this too. Hope that you can understand better about the system in Vietnam, and maybe it could be an inspiration for you to imagine about your future post-revolutionary society. Maybe it's something like to inspire you, give you some ideas to run a society after you had a revolution.
Yeah, the American Revolution is going to be so fucking ugly. That shit's going to be so fucking ugly. Can you imagine all their reactionaries just living out their apocalypse dreams?
Like,
who regime changed the regime?
Ecofascism. That's what I'm scared the most. The ecofascism. Yeah.
Thank you, Luna. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This is very, very, very fun. I'm very glad that you have me on your channel.
Thank you. Thank you. And you're always welcome to come back and scream at the white Marxists.